I next met with Dr. Mario Schnoll from the Yale Cancer Center in New Haven, Connecticut, and to begin, I asked him to comment on new developments in the adjuvant treatment of patients with melanoma.
Well, you know, we used interferon for years, and interferon was really replaced by ipilimumab some years ago. The problem with ipilimumab is that the initial trials used 10 milligrams per kilogram, which is a really toxic dose. There were data presented that showed that at least for relapse-free survival, 3 milligrams per kilogram of ipi was as good as 10 milligrams per kilogram. And so I think at that point, people switched over to 3 milligrams per kilogram, but that didn't last very long because it was soon, not too long ago, not soon after we started using ipilimumab, we learned that nivolumab actually was a much better drug. So in the adjuvant trial, nivolumab versus ipilimumab, and in this trial, they did use the 10 milligram per kilogram dose of ipilimumab. Clearly, nivolumab was better for progression-free survival. There's no survival data yet in that phase 3 trial. And then the other trial that changed the way we treat adjuvant patients involved the dabrafenib trametinib, which also showed a marked improvement in progression-free survival over, in that case, over control, over no treatment.
And kind of the global thought I've been hearing from investigators since that time was that it's kind of hard indirectly to separate out the benefit that you see with adjuvant BRAF as opposed to adjuvant nivolumab in BRAF patients. Is that still your take?
Yeah. First of all, a lot of us didn't really think that the BRAF MEK inhibitors would have such a profound effect in the adjuvant setting. We all knew the curves would separate for progression-free survival, but we thought that at the end of the year, when you finish treatment, those curves would come right back together. That didn't happen. Those curves stayed apart, and they're still apart. And in fact, there's an early trend toward an improvement of survival in that study. Although the problem with interpreting that survival data is that if you really look very carefully at the time of relapse, not all patients got dabrafenib trametinib. In fact, they probably didn't get the two drugs together, and that's better therapy. So had patients been treated, I think, optimally in the metastatic setting, we might not be seeing any difference in overall survival. We don't know. So if you have a patient who has a BRAF mutation and you're trying to decide whether to give a BRAF MEK inhibitor versus nivolumab, I'm not sure that we know which approach is going to be better. I favor giving adjuvant nivolumab. I think in the long run that's going to end up being better, but I don't know that we have data to prove that.
It's interesting when you talked about that, I was flashing on the adjuvant tamoxifen studies in breast cancer. You know, tamoxifen was thought to be a cytostatic agent. It wasn't going to work with. And then they saw this survival benefit. There was even a trial, I don't know if you know this, that compared to tamoxifen, literally tamoxifen adjuvant to tamoxifen on first relapse, and they still saw a survival benefit. So the other thing is, what about ipi-nivo in the adjuvant setting?
Well, that trial was done and completed. It used a lower dose of ipi and a less frequent schedule. It may be better than nivolumab in the adjuvant setting, but we don't have the data, and until it's analyzed, I don't think it should be used as standard of care. In the adjuvant setting, there are some patients where I consider using adjuvant ipi-nivo, and that would be, for example, in patients with mucosal melanomas. For those patients, I'm hesitant to use nivolumab alone because nivolumab in the advanced disease setting has a very low response rate in the mucosal melanoma patients.
Interesting. So you mentioned that you tend to favor nivolumab in the BRAF patients. In your mind, as you sit down and discuss this with a patient, I'm assuming this comes down to complications, quality of life, et cetera, since it's hard to separate out the benefit. In your mind, how do you compare these two courses? Or are you thinking, even though I don't see it in the data, maybe the immunotherapy is going to be better efficacy-wise?
So in the first year, if you look at progression-free survival, the BRAF-MEK agents look better. And the studies use slightly different patient populations. So I think in the adjuvant nivolumab trial, I think it started with 3B. I think the BRAF-MEK trial started with 3A patients. So you have to do a little back-of-the-envelope calculation to figure out it, to compare apples to apples. But I still think BRAF-MEK will probably, in terms of progression-free survival, be better in the first year. But when you start looking now at the two-year data, the numbers start looking, in terms of relapse-free survival, very similar to each other. So, you know, nivolumab in a small number of patients can have very serious toxicities, but it's IV, it's once a month, it's for a year. And based on everything we know about advanced disease, nivo gives you durable responses. BRAF-MEK rarely does. And so the more high risk the patient is, the more likely I am to use nivolumab. Interestingly enough, if I remember the BRAF-MEK study correctly, a lot of the effect, or at least the most impressive effect, was really in the 3A. So the earlier the disease, the bigger the effect. The later the disease, the smaller the effect. And again, I tend to favor Nevo in that group. But I give patients the choice, and there are some patients who want the BRAF MEK inhibitors.
Putting aside your thought that maybe it's going to be a better outcome from a tumor point of view, how do you compare it in terms of quality of life and, you know, the risk of serious complications? A lot of people kind of do view these as equivalent efficacy-wise, and that's when they start getting into these discussions about what people go through. How do you see it?
Let me address the efficacy question. I mean, in advanced disease, I don't think there's any question that nivolumab is better. If you looked at median survivals, the median survivals for nivolumab are better than for BRAF MEK inhibitors. If you're comparing, I think, apples to apples, the same group of patients. And I think that probably will translate into the adjuvant setting. In terms of quality of life, dabrafenib, trametinib actually is not so benign. Patients develop fevers, and there's a higher discontinuation rate than you might imagine in that group, probably because it's in the adjuvant setting and people don't want to push patients as hard. Overall, nivolumab is really very well tolerated. There's a small group, maybe 10%, that can develop severe toxicities. And by the way, if you develop a toxicity from nivolumab and you want to put those patients in on a BRAF MEK inhibitor, you can do that. I've never done that, but it's still possible to do that.
You can just switch them.
Yeah, you can just switch over if you think that that's necessary. I've not done that, though. If somebody is on Nevo, they develop toxicity, I take them off. I don't switch them over to a year of BRAF MEK inhibitors.
So one of the things I've heard people say is that they think it's safer to go the BRAF route. Yes, you have to deal with fevers or whatever, but that the risk of, quote, permanent complications is not as great as with immune therapy. And I was like, I had never thought about it that way. What are they talking about?
I think that's true. We've had an occasional patient with either pembrolizumab or nivolumab that's developed a really severe toxicity. I had a patient who developed myasthenia gravis after a single dose of pembrolizumab, and that patient was on a respirator for 3 months. So you can get really bad, bad toxicities. Interestingly enough, I've given, in a rare patient with BRAF MEK inhibitors, they've been admitted to the hospital and they've gotten severely ill, although in all those cases, the toxicities have been completely reversible. There's an occasional patient who gets anti-PD-1 that develops arthralgias, and those arthralgias don't go away. I mean, it may take a very long time for them to go away, or they just don't go away at all, and they become dependent on some form of treatment for those arthralgias, at least for a very long time. So you can develop long-term toxicities. And remember, there's an occasional patient who gets anti-PD-1 that gets pneumonitis and fatal pneumonitis. So I think there are rare, irreversible, or at least very long-term toxicities with the immune checkpoint inhibitors that you may not see with the BRAF MEK inhibitors.
That's interesting. I want to talk more with you about toxicity later, but I have to ask you about this myasthenia case. In that case, if you look back historically, were there any experiences, symptoms, anything that would suggest maybe there was sort of preclinical myasthenia?
In this patient, there was nothing. Nothing. We were surprised. I guess retrospectively, we would have gone back and said, he had a little droopy eye, but we didn't make anything of it at the time that we offered him the treatment, and he denied any prior autoimmunity when we started him on the pembrolizumab.
When you think about this kind of a case with this neurologic toxicity, in your mind, is it likely that it's sort of magnifying a pre-existing situation or really just de novo creating an autoimmune complication?
I think it could be both. I think in some people, they may have some predisposition and you may be exacerbating something and maybe subclinical. Well, those T cells have to be there, right? So it's some subclinical autoimmunity that you bring out by giving the anti-PD-1.
And once I start going on toxicity, we could just go all day long. I've got to ask you one other thing, and then we're going to get back to the adjuvant thing. But I have to ask you this, because actually we're getting ready to go to the SIDC meeting next week, and we're talking about lung cancer and immunotherapy. And, you know, small cell now has kind of come out on them. It has been for a while, but now maybe first line looks like they're going to be using checkpoint inhibitors. And I started thinking about people with small cell and paraneoplastic syndromes. I can't find anything, almost anything in the literature, just like a little bit. Do you know anything about that? Whether or not checkpoint inhibitors make, I mean, of course, if the tumor gets better, you would expect the paraneoplastic syndrome. But do you think that it would make the paraneoplastic syndrome worse in and of itself?
So I don't treat small cell, but I did take care of a patient in the hospital where I thought that the immune checkpoint inhibitor, the anti-PD-1, had made some paraneoplastic syndrome worse. And it was a neurologic paraneoplastic syndrome.
Wow.
It was a pretty bad syndrome. And it wasn't at a time when their disease was actually progressing, which you thought might have correlated. So, yeah, it's possible that in some people, a paraneoplastic syndrome might become worse, assuming you're not making their disease better.
What was this, a myopathy or what was?
It was some sort of encephalopathy.
Wow. So let's get back to adjuvant. I wanted to ask you, there was a presentation by Jeff Weber at ASCO with more data from the adjuvant Nevo, in particular the BRAF patients in the Nevo trial. Maybe you can talk about what he presented there.
So, you know, the effect was seen regardless of BRAF status. And the risk reduction, maybe a little bit less in the BRAF mutant patients, but still similar effect whether you had a BRAF mutation or not in terms of improvement in progression-free survival at the 24-month time point. And if you look carefully at the hazard ratios, again, maybe a little bit less, 0.73 in the BRAF mutants versus 0.61 in the BRAF wild type, but still a reasonable effect.
Well, let's move on and talk about some really interesting issues about toxicity. There's a lot to talk about. Maybe you can kind of go through it.
If you're just talking about anti-PD-1 alone, it's really very well tolerated. If you look at most of the studies, the grade 3-4 AEs, all grade 3-4 AEs are in the 15% range, 15 to 20% range. If you look at select AEs, it's less than 10%. When you start combining anti-PD-1 with any anti-CTLA-4, the rate of grade 3-4 AEs goes up substantially, right? If you combine it with ipilimumab, depending on the dose of ipilimumab, that rate of grade 3-4 AE could go from 15% with Nevo alone, not much higher really with Ipi alone, all the way up to anywhere from 30 to 60% grade 3-4 AEs.
So as long as you bring that up about combined therapy, kind of the global kind of feeling I've had talking to people has been is that it's more toxicity, but the same types of toxicity. Is that the case, or is it a different toxicity profile qualitatively?
It's the same type of toxicity, but really compared to ipilimumab more so than nivolumab. So you really just see the ipilimumab toxicities. They're actually very similar, regardless whether it's ipilimumab or nivolumab. They're very similar adverse effects. I think with anti-PD-1, you see more arthralgias, you see more pneumonitis. You don't see that as much with anti-CTLA-4. But when you combine the two, what you're really doing is you're taking the ipilimumab toxicities and you're seeing higher incidence, more severity. So the most common toxicity manifestations involve the skin, the GI tract, the endocrine organs, liver, and then a little bit further down, lung and kidney. Really, the most common thing you see is skin. You rarely see severe skin toxicities, but you can see skin toxicities. The ones that we worry most about are gastrointestinal toxicities. Those are the ones where that you really need to act on right away. As far as symptoms are concerned, patients really present with fatigue, rash, pruritus, arthralgias, diarrhea, nausea, mucositis, some patients with dry eye, dry mouth. You really have to have very close communication with the patients. You really have to have your nurses call them. You have to have them call your nurses. And you really have to treat them early for these adverse events. Otherwise, they can get really very ill. So those are the most common toxicities. But what we're seeing now when we're treating many more patients are really rare adverse events that can be potentially life-threatening. So we see in some patients inflammatory syndromes, for example, HLH, hematopoietic lymphohistiocytosis, which is often fatal. Of the gastrointestinal toxicities, you see colitis, that's common, but sometimes you can see a bowel perforation. Pancreatitis is rare, but we've seen it. Cardiovascular toxicities are now being seen, and there are patients that have died from myocarditis and CHF. A rare Stevens-Johnson syndrome. If you develop Stevens-Johnson syndrome, it's likely going to be fatal. It's a bad toxicity.
That's kind of interesting. Can you remind us about the pathophysiology of Stevens-Johnson syndrome and why it would get worse? I mean, I know it's an immune, you know, sort of based, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's just a very severe form of skin toxicity. It's probably T-cell mediated. I don't think it's antibody mediated. We've seen bullous pemphigoid, which I think is antibody mediated.
Right.
But I think Stevens-Johnson's is a more T-cell mediated toxicity. But when we see it, it's rapidly progressive. It's hard to turn off. And I've only seen one case myself. I'm not even sure that it was the immune checkpoint inhibitor because the patient was also on Bactrim at the same time, but had a very rapid progressive course and died in the ICU. So the other things that we're seeing now a little bit more commonly that used to be rare, in fact, we were among the first to report it, we've seen patients develop insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus, and that diabetes mellitus can be very brittle. You have to have an endocrinologist help you to manage that because they're very hard to manage.
So presumably it's type 1 diabetes.
Yeah, it is. It's type 1 diabetes. They lose their pancreas. They're insulin dependent, but they're very brittle. You need somebody who really knows how to manage the toxicity to get these patients through. We've seen really debilitating rheumatologic disorders, arthralgias. They are often responsive to steroids. The myositis can be reversed relatively quickly, but some patients who develop myositis can also develop myocarditis. And you have to, if you see somebody, they come in weak or with myalgias, you get a CK, the CK is high, you should check for troponins. If they have myocarditis, they should be in the hospital. And I've seen myositis, myocarditis, and myasthenia gravis in the same patient.
Wow. When you see myositis and myocarditis, what's going on? I mean, it's different types of muscles.
Again, we don't know the pathophysiology, but it's, again, a potentially life-threatening complication. And then for the CNS toxicities, in addition to myasthenia, which is already bad enough, we've seen an optic neuritis that led to blindness in one patient. We've seen uveitis. The uveitis is most often reversible. And then this ascending or multifocal neuropathy, that I've seen more with ipilimumab alone, where we used to give 10 milligrams per kilogram. I can't say I've seen it very often, but it's a very scary adverse effects. People come in with leg weakness. We bring them into the hospital. We give them IVIG. We give them steroids. And that weakness doesn't go away right away. It can take months before they recover
function. So this is
function.
An MS-type kind of syndrome?
No, it's different. It's actually probably a demyelinating neuropathy.
Hmm.
So it's very important, I think, if you're going to give these drugs. It's one of the problems about giving any oncologic agent outside of a major center. That's true for any agent. You have to have a multidisciplinary team that really knows how to manage these adverse events. Before, we used to manage the gastrointestinal toxicities and endocrine toxicities. I can manage mostly by myself. When people start developing severe neurologic toxicities, insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus, you really need that expertise from other subspecialties in order to get these patients through the agent safely. The good news is that these toxicities that are hard to manage are very rare, and the vast majority of patients have reversible toxicity. So,
what about the radiation necrosis? I hadn't heard that before.
So we don't know for sure that that's tied into the immune checkpoint inhibitors, but many patients with melanoma, as you know, present with brain metastases. These days, we don't necessarily give them gamma knife radiation or stereotactic radiation because they can respond to ipilimumab, nivolumab. In fact, that's a subgroup of patients that probably should get the combination versus nivo alone. So if you're not treating them with radiation, you don't have to worry about radiation necrosis. But some patients you do treat with gamma knife radiation or stereotactic radiation. They either get the immune checkpoint inhibitors after or concurrently. And in those patients, even though the brain lesion goes away, anywhere from months to years later, you can start seeing enhancement at the area that you treated before. And sometimes the edema around that can become enormous and can cause almost as many symptoms as a lesion itself. And our sense is that the immune checkpoint inhibitors may exacerbate the development of the radiation necrosis.
It's really interesting. In general, how well do these CNS problems respond to corticosteroids?
They do respond to corticosteroids fairly well, but in some patients, you have to resect the area of radiation necrosis. There's a method called LIT, which is a laser that you can actually insert into the lesion, and that can sometimes take care of the necrosis. And in some patients, we've had to give them bevacizumab in order to manage the edema around the radiation necrosis.
How much of an issue is having, you know, ER docs, primary care docs tuned in to these problems? And what are you doing at Yale about approaching that? How important do you think it is?
I think it's very important, and I can't say we're doing at Yale as much about this as we should, but certainly through the SITC, we've created educational programs, including programs with community oncology centers so that we can educate the emergency room physicians who, in some cases, see these toxicities before we do. So you're right, it's a very important thing to do, but the programs are being put out there through larger organizations. I think the last toxicity here that we should mention is an occasional patient will develop hematologic toxicity. So they'll develop severe, for example, hemolytic anemias or pancytopenias. I had one patient who came in with a white count of zero, low platelet counts, pancytopenia. She responded to steroids, but it was a very scary situation, and now she's back to normal. Her count's eventually recovered. It's another person that we gave steroids and IVIG. So you need to be on the lookout for this, and it's a very good idea to have your hematologic consultant available when these bizarre toxicities occur. ITP has been seen, for example. So the question is, how do you manage these toxicities? And it's really important to understand that there are algorithms already developed that you can access online that help you to manage the toxicities. But primarily, the first thing is you need to monitor these patients very closely. You need to establish a relationship with them. You need to be sure that they can come into the center if they have toxicities. If it's somebody that lives far away and can't get transportation into a major center, that you have to worry about that person. We often encourage them to call frequently. And once we know that they're having, for example, if they start developing diarrhea, we don't depend on them specifically to call us. We actually proactively check on them to make sure that their symptoms aren't worse. At the very first visit, I have to tell patients, don't be stoic, don't be afraid to call us. Even if you have one or two episodes of diarrhea, if you have something that's unusual, call us, let us manage it. And if we have to, we bring them into an emergency room. Major centers often have oncology emergency centers that are better for patients. So I think that's the first thing. The nursing staff is really critical in terms of managing these adverse effects. Supportive care is very important. People will develop, in some cases, nausea. For the diarrhea, sometimes we give Imodium, although we try and stay away from Imodium because we want to understand the severity of the symptoms. The single most important thing that you can do is start steroids when steroids are indicated, and to start the right dose of steroids. For most of these toxicities, especially severe toxicities, we usually want to start at somewhere around 2 mg per kg of solumedrol. And for some toxicities, for example, if somebody comes in with uveitis and loss of vision, we put them in the hospital and we give them a gram of solumedrol daily for 3 days. So I would not be scared about going too high on the steroids when you need it. And also not to stop the steroids too quickly. Some people will give the high dose of steroids, people will reverse right away, and they'll want to stop the steroids right away. For grade 3 or grade 4 colitis, you don't want to do that. You want to give them a week of high-dose steroids and then taper them over 35 to 40 days. We have a very low threshold to put somebody in the hospital. A lot of these can be managed as an outpatient, but I think if somebody comes in with grade 3 or 4 diarrhea, I'd rather have them in the hospital, control it in the hospital. One of the things that fools us often is that they get better. We'll give them 2 mg per kg of solumedrol. They'll look better after 24 hours. We send them home. 24 hours later, they're on oral prednisone. Their symptoms come back, sometimes even worse. So I may keep them an extra day, and if I see their symptoms come back, those are the people that I might actually give a secondary immunosuppressive, like infliximab, for example. The other things are just common sense medicine. Most of the time you attribute these things to drug, but you have to be sure that you rule out other causes. I've had people who've come in with diarrhea we thought was related to the immune checkpoints, but it turned out to be C. diff.
Wow.
It was an infectious cause. And sometimes they can be present in the same patient. So that's another twist. Some people who have recurrent colitis, you think that you're dealing with recurrent colitis when actually you're dealing with CMV colitis that occurred because of the immune suppression. And then the last thing is really stay alert for severe symptoms. I mean, if somebody is weak, now when somebody calls and they're weak, we get cortisol levels, we get TSH, we get free T4, I get a CK because I've been fooled. And in somebody who has symptoms that look like myasthenia, droopy eyes, they can't lift their neck, we'll get neurology involved and get an antibody against acetylcholine receptor to make sure that they haven't developed myasthenia.
You know, when you were talking about trying to, you know, find out early on that these people have problems, I was flashing on the fact that we had the pleasure of working with Ethan Bosch a couple of times this year, who did that ASCO plenary presentation on, you know, the sort of automated preemptive approach where patients are, you know, now I think they're using phones and apps and all, putting their symptoms in on a regular basis that gets triaged to a nurse. And it seems like that would really be ideal for these kinds of patients.
It is. I personally prefer for them to call my nurse. I'm worried that there's somebody on the other end of that phone, you know, reading the text. And a lot of people have Epic now, and Epic has a MyChart feature. And sometimes people will send in their symptoms on MyChart. I don't know who's looking at that and when they're looking at it. If I'm on a plane, I can't look at it. And so I tell people to call our staff and to keep calling until they get a call back from either our fellow or our nurse. So I haven't gotten to the point yet where I trust those systems yet.
That's a good point. What are some of the main questions involved in AE management right now?
Well, it's like anything else in medicine. It's a differential diagnosis. Is it disease or is it drug-related or is it something else? I think that for a lot of us, we've been doing this so long that we skip the additional diagnostic test. So I don't really do colonoscopies anymore for colitis. I get the stool cultures. I get fecal leukocytes, C. diff. But I don't even get a CT anymore. Often I'll just go ahead and treat with steroids. Although CTs are helpful because if you see stranding or inflammation around the bowel, it can tell you that things are a little bit more serious than you might have imagined. If somebody comes in and has pneumonitis, do you do a bronchoscopy or not, or do you go ahead and treat with steroids? Because sometimes these people have secondary infections. Another really difficult part in the clinic is when to start steroids. So it's an easy decision when somebody comes in with severe symptoms, but somebody who calls in and says, you know, I have a little bit of diarrhea and a little bit of nausea, do you start steroids then or do you wait a day or two to start them? I tend to not start people with very mild symptoms right away. But those are the people that I have my nurses call every day or every other day to make sure that their symptoms aren't escalating rapidly. And when you start steroids, again, if it's severe, it's easy. You start high-dose steroids. But there are people that you can manage with a Medrol pack or with 30 milligrams or 40 milligrams of prednisone for a couple of weeks. And so knowing when to back off a little bit on the steroids, I think, is important. And you're going to ask, well, why do you need to back off on the steroids? It turns out that giving steroids often doesn't affect the efficacy of the treatment, but we're always a little bit concerned. So if I can avoid giving high-dose steroids for prolonged periods, I'll try and do so. But if somebody's really sick or if I think they're going to get sick, I don't hold back. I give them what they need. The other problem in the clinic has to do with if somebody is already on steroids but they're not responding to the steroids, do you go up on the steroids or do you add a second agent? The most common agents are mycophenolate, which we use for liver toxicity. We don't use infliximab for liver toxicity because that can cause liver toxicity in and of itself. For other adverse events outside of the liver, the second agent is usually infliximab or an anti-TNF. And then the question is whether to use the standard dose of infliximab, which is 5 mg per kg, or go right to 10 mg per kg. And then how often to give. Some people don't respond to the first dose of infliximab, so 2 weeks later or a week later you might give, instead of 5, you might give the 10 mg per kg. I think when somebody starts to develop a toxicity, the other simple things are how often do you monitor them in clinic? And one of the questions that often comes up is if somebody develops a severe adverse event, can you re-challenge them after the toxicity resolves? And that's a really difficult problem. I can tell you that in one patient of mine that had uveitis, terrible uveitis, 2 years later she had a recurrence. We rechallenged her with ipilimumab, nivolumab, and interestingly enough, she did not develop recurrent uveitis. Wow. On the other hand, almost everybody that I've rechallenged who had colitis in the past had recurrent colitis. But I have rechallenged patients. If they've had very, very severe colitis, I tend not to do it. But it's a clinical question, and if you think that rechallenging them at some point would give you benefit and you have nothing else for those patients, you might consider giving them the ipilimumab, nivolumab in this case, and then just saying, I'll just manage the toxicity when it comes up.
So we've covered a lot of ground with regard to management of common and rare adverse events associated with checkpoint inhibitors. Maybe you could just distill it down to the general principles you use in managing these problems.
These are just general principles that we use. For any severe event, once we start them on high-dose steroids, we usually maintain the high-dose steroids until the event resolves. And then we taper over slowly over about 30 to 40 days. When somebody has a really bad adverse event, it's okay to think about using pulse high-dose solumedrol for a gram a day for 3 days and then bringing them back down. If the AEs persist or recur, sometimes you have to use a second agent, and that would be an anti-TNF or mycophenolate, as we've talked about before. Not all toxicities can be managed with steroids or mycophenolate infliximab. Sometimes you have to use other things like IVIG or plasma exchange, especially for events like myasthenia, neurologic toxicities. And some people have used an anti-IL-6 receptor for HLH, for hematopoietic lymphohistiocytosis, which is a very bad toxicity. And then again, if you're going to consider rechallenging patients, generally it's okay if their immune adverse event was less than grade 3 and if it resolved rapidly, and if you think that if they get the recurrence of the toxicity, that they won't have major morbidity. But if it was a very severe event if it didn't resolve very rapidly, or if it's an organ that you might be afraid to, for example, it was a bad neurologic toxicity before, you may not want to expose them again to these agents. Those are really the general principles. You can rechallenge if you've given ipilimumab before, ipilimumab, nivolumab, and they've had a bad toxicity. You can go back to nivolumab again. Often the toxicities are related to the ipilimumab component and not to the anti-PD-1 component. So you can go to anti-PD-1 when you've had a severe toxicity to the combination. But in some of those patients, you may not ever want to give them ipilimumab again. I tell my colleagues to use consultants, but also to beware of some of the recommendations, because the management of these toxicities are not identical to the same entity that would have occurred without the immune checkpoints. So just become familiar with it and question the consultant about whether what some consultants, for example, might come in and see pneumonitis and say, oh, you only need to give them 40 milligrams of prednisone. You might want to question that approach. If somebody has been on immune checkpoint on immunosuppressives for more than 4 weeks, especially if they're on dual immunosuppressives, have to start thinking about giving them Bactrim to prevent pneumocystis and maybe acyclovir, and watch carefully for secondary infections. We've seen, for example, CMV colitis in people who've been on steroids for a while for immune-related colitis. And I tend to reassure patients that their AEs will resolve over time. So it's really important to prepare people up front to say, if you have one of these events, it may take months before you get over this. We may take a while to get you off the steroids. And so that way they're mentally prepared for a long slog, especially if they're benefiting. You want them not to put up with it, but to sort of persevere until you could get them through this. The adverse events that don't resolve are the endocrinopathies, and it's very important to tell people up front, you may lose your thyroid, you may lose your pituitary, and you might have to be on hormone replacements for the rest of your life.
I'm just kind of curious, how many patients would you guess you have in your practice right now who are on checkpoint inhibitors?
Well, since I treat melanoma and kidney cancer, it would be...
like hundreds?
Well, they're not on forever.
You know, yeah,
we
no,
do
I understand.
Stop the drugs, yeah. But yeah, I would say...
That's interesting. What tends to be the time course of when you see this spectrum of problems?
Those data have been published. It's very variable. Some patients will develop toxicities within the first week. Some people can develop it weeks after their last dose. And some things like arthralgias can occur very late. Renal toxicities can occur very late after patients have been on treatment for a while. It's not true that if you've been on treatment for 6 or 8 months that you won't develop an adverse event. We've seen toxicities. For example, when we were giving ipilimumab, we've seen toxicities develop, GI toxicities, a year or a year and a half later.
While they're still on the drug, though?
Yeah, they were still on the drug.
One other sort of related issue is the management. And again, you know, you hear this on many different cancers now, and I know everything's different, but I'm curious about the management of the patient who's progressing, at least by imaging, on a checkpoint inhibitor. Kind of the global sort of approach that I've heard in general for a long time is, if the patient's clinically stable, keep going. Is that still the way you approach these patients?
Yes. Well, there are different kinds of progression. And it also depends when they're progressing. If they're progressing early, that could be pseudo-progression. You may want to continue for a while longer to make sure they don't have late responses. If they've been on treatment for a while and they just have one site of progression or a limited number of sites of progression, you can treat those locally with radiation or surgery and you're still getting substantial benefit. But the person who's getting multiple sites of progression while they're on treatment, those patients you shouldn't continue on therapy. There is a caveat, though. Let's say that you've received ipilimumab, nivolumab, and you've responded. You then go on nivolumab. You're on nivolumab for a while, and on nivolumab, you develop disease progression, even in multiple sites. Some of those people you can reinduce with ipilimumab, nivolumab again and see a second response. So those people you can go back to the original induction regimen and get additional benefit. If somebody has received treatment, has gone off treatment for some period of time, and then starts to progress, those people can be reinduced often with the same drugs. And in some percentage of those patients, they will have a second response.
What about the so-called phenomenon of hyperprogression? Do you believe it exists? Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it in melanoma, and I haven't seen it in kidney cancer. My colleagues who treat lung cancer or head and neck cancer are convinced that it exists.
Those are bad diseases too, you know? But we'll see. You know, another thought as you were chatting, I was thinking about another issue that I hear a lot about from oncologists. And of course, this goes way outside melanoma, which is the issue of stopping or how long you can use a checkpoint inhibitor. And that kind of gets woven in because once you see toxicities, that thought comes into your mind. So how do you think through in melanoma the issue of stopping checkpoint inhibitor therapy or duration of treatment?
Melanoma may be different than other diseases because we really do see CRs that are durable when we stop the drug. So somebody develops grade 3 or 4 toxicity from ipilimumab, nivolumab, but they have a complete response when we finish their steroids. I don't often give them nivolumab maintenance. If they don't have a complete response, I may give them nivolumab maintenance for 6 months or 8 months. But if they've been in a continuous CR for 2 sets of scans, for example, I'll stop the drug. One of the things that we like to do is, and this is work done by Georgina Long, but we've been doing it outside of study data for a while. After about a year, when I think somebody has had a stable response for a long period, I'll do a PET scan. And if the PET scan is clean, if there's no uptake, even in things that look like disease, I feel much more comfortable about stopping them. If there's still active disease there, I probably will continue the drug for a while longer. It's really important in melanoma when you have residual activity. I take those things out. We've had a couple of patients that have stopped drug, that have had lymph nodes or other areas with very low level FDG activity. In some cases, we take that out and it's just necrotic mess. But in some cases, it's still melanoma. And so we take those out. And in some cases, we see very long progression-free survival after doing that. But the short answer to your question is, we tend not to go much beyond a year, year and a half. We tend to do those PETs when we think they've had their best response. They are not responding additionally to drug. And if those PETs are negative, we feel very comfortable taking them off drug at that point.
I want to ask you about a couple related issues. One is the issue of patients with known prior immune disease at the time you're considering checkpoint therapy. Of course, it's different in the adjuvant setting versus metastatic, of course, the type of cancer, et cetera. But globally, what do we know about the effect of checkpoint inhibitors on prior autoimmune disease?
Well, we don't know a lot. There's a retrospective paper that's put together from the experience of a number of institutions. And it looks like sometimes you exacerbate the prior disease and sometimes you don't, or sometimes you get a different autoimmunity than the one they had when they started the treatment. I think it's a risk-benefit question for most patients, and if you have metastatic cancer, your metastatic cancer is much more dangerous to you than any autoimmune toxicity, well, than most autoimmune toxicities that you might develop as a result of the drugs. And for most autoimmune toxicities, you can reverse the course with steroids. You can treat the autoimmunity with steroids and reverse the toxicity. So I think in patients who come to me with prior autoimmunity, I go through the risk-benefit with them. But in most of the cases, we decide to go ahead and treat them with the checkpoint inhibitors. Now, it could be that in some patients, I may not give them ipi-nivo. I might just give them nivolumab alone, although that's not based on any data because it could be that the nivolumab is worse for exacerbating their autoimmune toxicity than the ipilimumab. We have a patient who had multiple sclerosis, and we've given her ipilimumab, we've given her pembrolizumab, we've given her the combination of ipilimumab and nivolumab, and her multiple sclerosis has not changed. We've never made it worse, it seems like, with these drugs. You would have expected that she would have been very debilitated by this, but that's really not the case.
Are there any, I mean, of course, the severity, the threat, how much treatment, all these things come into play, but just inherently, are there some autoimmune problems that because of the biology you're more concerned about? I've heard people say isolate multiple sclerosis as an example of a type of sort of pathophysiology that should be worse. And then you could look at psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis. When you look at the different pathophysiologies, are there some that sort of jump out at you as being more likely to get worse, or do we have any clinical data on it?
We don't have clinical data. There's a study that's being put together by the NCI. To look at this, they're going to take groups of patients with each of those different autoimmunities, treat them with nivolumab, and then in a very careful, premeditated way, study their outcomes. And I think that's going to be very valuable. At the moment, it's all anecdotal. Obviously, we're not going to be treating patients with these agents if they have autoimmune toxicities and they're requiring large doses of immunosuppression. Because if they're on large doses of immunosuppression up front, it's very unlikely that the checkpoint inhibitors are going to work. So the patients that we're really talking about are patients who have a history of autoimmunity, but they're really not currently on major immunosuppression. They may be on very low-dose steroids, for example. And those are the ones that we're considering for these drugs.
What about a patient with solid organ transplants, you know, kidney, liver, heart?
There's data in the literature. I would be very hesitant to give those patients immune checkpoint inhibitors. I think some patients have been reported to have rejected their transplants because of this. But again, it's a risk-benefit ratio. So there is a set of allo transplants that I would consider. So we've published on patients who had allogeneic bone marrow transplants in the remote past. And we've given those patients ipilimumab and nivolumab, small number of patients, and we've gotten away with it. They haven't rejected their graft. But if you've had a kidney transplant or a heart transplant, that may be a different risk-benefit.
These patients, are they on chronic immune suppressives?
No. So the ones that the allo bone marrow transplant patients that we treated with checkpoint inhibitors were not on any immune suppressives at the time.
What do we know right now about the relationship, if any, of autoimmune toxicity treatment benefit?
It's a hard question. Let's take nivolumab, for example. If you look at the nivolumab data in melanoma, and these data have been published by Jeff Weber et al., there is a correlation between response rate and development of any toxicity or any select toxicity. So for nivolumab, patients who develop toxicity appear to have at least better objective response rates. For ipilimumab, nivolumab, that's also true, but almost everybody who receives ipilimumab, nivolumab develops an adverse event. The ones that don't do much worse. We've shown that. But a lot of those patients never made it beyond one or two cycles because their disease was progressing so rapidly. So we can't tell whether that's because they're not responding to the drug or because they just got a couple of cycles. They didn't get enough drug to develop an autoimmune toxicity. We've also looked for ipilimumab, nivolumab, whether it makes a difference whether you get your adverse event early, before 12 weeks, or after 12 weeks. And it doesn't seem to make a difference in terms of overall outcome.
One final thing I want to ask you about is I've always been fascinated by the emerging research looking at the biome, the microbiome. And there have been some reports coming out maybe linking some of that to checkpoint inhibitors, also the issue of antibiotics and checkpoint inhibitors.
So there are a couple of groups that have looked at use of antibiotics in the period immediately before getting checkpoint inhibitors and in the 2 or 3 months after receiving checkpoint inhibitors. And they've reported primarily in unvalidated cohorts, although modest-sized cohorts, that patients who receive the antibiotics will have a worse outcome, presumably because you're modulating the microbiome in those patients. I think we have to wait to see bigger sets of data before we believe that that's true. I obviously try and avoid antibiotics if I have to in those patients based on that data, but if somebody needs antibiotics, they need antibiotics. The data from Jen Wargo and Tom Gajewski and a few others, Lorraine Zitkovel, I think also, suggests that there are certain bacterial species that are associated with better response or with worse response to the immune checkpoint inhibitors. The question is, again, will those validate in larger cohorts and in second cohorts? I suspect there is a role. I just don't know how big of a role. And it seems hard for me to believe that your gut bacteria will be the ultimate determinant of whether you respond to an immune checkpoint inhibitor or not. Maybe there are people who can't prime because they don't have the right microbiome. Maybe that's a reason why they don't have T cells in the microenvironment. But the more direct biomarker might be to look at the microenvironment. The other question is, can you modulate their microbiome and make them sensitive to immune checkpoints? And those trials are ongoing now.
Just flashing on a conversation I had with Jeff Weber. I guess he's interested in, he collects stool specimens on these patients. I'm interested to see how that goes.
I've tried to get our people to collect and store stool specimens. They haven't been too enthusiastic about it.
So let's talk a little bit about your cases, beginning with your 64-year-old patient.
So this is a 64-year-old who had rapidly progressive, newly diagnosed BRAF positive, V600E, BRAF mutation, metastatic melanoma. Probably don't have to go through the primary presentation, but he, about January of 2018, he had had a prior melanoma years ago. He was doing very well, but around May of this year, he started developing nonspecific abdominal pain, increasing abdominal girth, and early satiety. And his symptoms increased. He went to see his primary care physician, was started on antibiotics. They thought he had diverticulitis. His symptoms persisted, and then he came to us. They did the scans before he came to us, and he had this huge mass in the abdomen. It was in the middle of the abdomen. It was standing down into the pelvis. It was at least 20 centimeters by the time I saw him, but it had been growing very rapidly over a period of around 4 weeks. He had a laparoscopy. They did a biopsy. It turned out to be, as I said, melanoma. It was BRAF V600E mutation positive. And when I saw him in the clinic, he was really in bad shape. He had bilateral peripheral edema. He had ascites. He was symptomatic. And we had to make a decision at that point after we fully staged him whether to give him a BRAF MEK inhibitor or Ipi/Nivo.
I was just flashing on the fact that this is the one case that I can see you're going to use BRAF therapy. This is the classic Dr. Schnoll BRAF case, I guess. Does it have to be this bad, incidentally?
It does, actually. So anything short of somebody this sick, I would use ipilimumab, nivolumab first. But in this gentleman, his disease was growing really as I was talking to him. And he was very symptomatic. We had a very long discussion internally whether to give him ipilimumab, nivolumab first or BRAF MEK inhibitor first. And I can't say all of my colleagues that I work with agreed. They're very much believers in that you can see very rapid responses to ipilimumab, nivolumab. And if this person had had a wild-type tumor, no question we would have given him ipilimumab, nivolumab. And we've seen benefit in those patients.
What would you say is the response rate in this situation to both strategies?
Well, to the BRAF MEK inhibitors, the response rate is very high. You'll see improvement. The problem is, in somebody who comes in with this kind of rapidly progressive disease, high LDH, huge masses, they'll respond for some period of time, and then they'll progress. And if you look at the survival of patients who start with high LDH and get BRAF MEK inhibitors, it's not very good. On the other hand, if you look at ipilimumab, nivolumab, and you look at patients who come in with high LDH, you cure some of those people.
What about response rate with Ipi/Nivo?
That data is known. I have to actually look at the forest plot from 067 to tell you what that is.
But what about globally? You're talking about in terms of LDH high, but I mean in general.
Oh, in general, the response rate to Ipi/Nivo is somewhere between 55 to 60% patients with metastatic melanoma who present without any prior treatment.
What happened with this patient?
So I gave him a BRAF MEK inhibitor. Within days, he started to feel better, within days. And I saw him every 2 weeks to make sure that he could tolerate the drugs. He did not get the fever, some of the dabrafenib, trametinib. We scanned him at 6 weeks. He had an amazing response. Still had a huge mass, but it was now, instead of a solid mass, it was mostly internally necrotic. His lung lesions disappeared. His peripheral edema went away. His performance status went from a 2 or 3 to a 0. So he was now eating well, energy levels normal, no pain. And at this point, we ordered the ipilimumab, nivolumab. We're going to keep the BRAF MEK inhibitor going until the day that we start Ipi/Nivo. And then we're going to follow him weekly in the clinic to make sure that his disease doesn't come roaring back when he's off the drugs.
I'm going to guess that if I presented this to a whole bunch of melanoma investigators, not all of them would do exactly what you did, at least in terms of adding the Ipi/Nivo. Oh, this is the one progression you're going to keep?
No.
That's what I thought. You're just going to go ahead and switch him.
I'm switching him at 6 weeks.
So am I correct in saying not necessarily all investigators would do that, or you think most people would?
Not all investigators would do that.
I've never even heard people talk about this, to be honest with you.
You mean switching over?
Or? Yeah, just switching over in somebody who's responding well to BRAF MEK therapy.
You know, we know from the data that these people will do horribly if you just keep them on the BRAF MEK inhibitors. Now, you may, if you switch them at the very first sign of progression, that might be okay. If you give them Ipi/Nivo at the very first sign of progression off the BRAF MEK inhibitors, they might do just as well. But when they start to progress, sometimes they can progress very rapidly.
I mean, aren't there patients, though, with very, very prolonged responses to BRAF MEK inhibition? I mean, like 5 years or more?
In this subgroup, not many.
Because of this subgroup, I see. So this strategy is really, so you wouldn't necessarily do this for some other patient.
Oh, no.
I say it's because of the tumor burden. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in terms of now, this patient actually got dabrafenib, trametinib. I'm going to ask you about other options, but what happened in terms of side effects also?
He had a little bit of fever in the first few days. He didn't actually stop the drug, even though that's what we usually tell them to do. About 4 or 5 weeks in, he also developed a fever. He stopped the drug for a couple of days and then restarted, but had no other adverse effects from the BRAF MEK inhibitor.
Any comments on what your experience has been with fevers and other side effects?
With the dabrafenib, trametinib, a reasonable number of patients get troublesome fevers. You can manage it. Most people, you manage it by just stopping the drug. They go on Motrin. You wait 24 hours until the last fever and they restart the drugs. Usually the fevers occur early on during treatment. They get to a point where they rarely get fevers. But I've also had patients who the fevers actually get worse and I've had to take them off drug. And they get bad fevers, 102, they feel terrible. So it's actually a little, we can manage it, but it is a little bit of a problem in management. I don't think it decreases efficacy. And as I've said, we've only had to take off a few patients because of fevers.
I'm curious, we now have encorafenib and imatinib available. Can you talk about the data we have there and how it compares to, for example, tivrafenib, trametinib?
So the incidence of fevers is much lower with encorafenib. Bimetinib. That's the only problem with those drugs. Yeah, I have to learn how to pronounce those drugs. But so, you know, now we're starting people more on encorafenib and bimetinib than we are on dabrafenib, trametinib, just simply because the fevers are easier to manage. There are less incidence of fever.
Any sense about efficacy? I've heard people say that they think maybe it's more efficacious, but not for sure.
I myself have not examined the data in great detail, but the people who have suggested the difference in efficacy may be just due to the patient selection, and that it may not really be more efficacious than the other combinations.
Why don't we go on to your next case, a 68-year-old patient.
This is a 68-year-old. We saw around Christmas time of 2015, he scraped his skin and actually started bleeding. It's a lesion on the skin. He went to see his dermatologist. Basically, the dermatologist found two suspicious lesions, both of which turned out to be deep melanomas, 2C melanomas, very deep and ulcerated melanomas. I do believe he underwent sentinel node biopsies, which were negative. So the final stage was 2C, but two separate lesions. What was interesting is that when we did the molecular analysis of these lesions, one turned out to have an NRAS mutation, the other one turned out to have a BRAF mutation. So he then presented sometime later with, he went to his dermatologist. The dermatologist noted a mass in his left forearm. And we biopsied that mass. It turned out to be melanoma. And when we did staging, he had extensive metastatic disease. So we also did a molecular analysis on that recurrent tumor, and it turned out to be the NRAS mutant, not the BRAF mutant.
Wow.
He had other mutations. It's not terribly important for this discussion. We also, not uniformly at our institution, but I do PD-L1 assays on these patients. We use not the C223 antibody. We use another antibody. But in any event, the results are very similar. David Rim has shown that the results using any of these antibodies were very similar. Turned out that he had 5 to 10% of tumor cells that stained positive for PD-L1. We decided, even though he had a PD-L1 positive tumor, because of the extensive disease that he had, that we would go ahead and give him the standard dose of ipilimumab and nivolumab. We gave him 3 mg per kg of ipi together with 1 mg per kg of nivo every 3 weeks, starting actually in mid-June of this year. And again, this is a patient who had a high LDH, an extensive disease, at the time that he started treatment, although the difference between this patient and the last patient is that the rate of progression wasn't nearly as rapid and the extent of disease wasn't as large, and he wasn't nearly as symptomatic when he came in. So after the second cycle, he developed diarrhea, but it self-resolved, so we didn't have to give him any treatment.
Before you go on, could I just kind of stop at this point? You mentioned he had an NRAS mutation. Where are we today in terms of targeted therapy of these patients?
Nothing that's approved. There was a study with BIMI, which is a MEK inhibitor, which was really a negative study, but may have shown a little bit of activity in patients who have had prior immune checkpoint inhibitors, slight improvement in progression-free survival. But I would say we have nothing effective for this group of patients at this point.
The other question is, and you know, it's funny because every time I ask somebody about PD-1 levels of melanoma, they all say they don't do them. So I'm glad you do, because I was going to ask you, like, what's a high level? What's like the highest you would see?
I've seen people with 50, 60%, 90%.
So, for example, if this patient had had a 50, 60%, still ipi-nivo, or would you have thought about nivo alone?
It's a really hard question. If you look at the 067 data, in a retrospective post hoc analysis looking at PD-L1 of less than 1% versus 1% or greater, in the ones who had PD-L1 1% or greater, there seemed to be no difference in overall survival between the combination and anti-PD-1 alone, ipi-nivo and anti-PD-1 alone. It was in the group that was PD-L1 negative by that assay that appeared to have most of the benefit from addition of ipi. But there are other data that suggests that, and again, it's not broken down by PD-L1 status, that the patients who get Ipi-Nivo, even though their survival may be the same, even when you look at it 3 or 4 years, fewer of the patients who had Ipi-Nivo required additional treatment beyond the anti-PD-1. So you got them into remission and they stayed in remission.
I mean, that initial data sounded like it was kind of an interesting algorithm, made a lot of sense to me anyhow. And then started asking people and kind of people, it seemed like more the way people look at it, I don't know whether you do, is if the patient can tolerate Ipi-Nivo and they have metastatic disease, give it to them.
That's mostly the way we approach it. But we really need more data because you're buying a whole lot more toxicity, as you'll see in this patient, by adding the ipilimumab. And if, in fact, at the end of the day, survival is going to be the same, that might not be the right strategy for a subgroup of patients.
Any other biomarkers that might be helpful or being looked at? Of course, in other cancers, tumor mutation burdens being looked at. Is that helpful at all?
Not in melanoma, not as far as I know, in terms of differentiating between using the combination versus anti-PD-1 alone. So I get it. Whether I actually act on the assay or not depends on the individual patient. If you have somebody who's 75 years old and wants treatment and has a lot of other comorbidities and they have, you know, they're PD-L1 positive, that patient I might give anti-PD-1 to. On the other hand, if they're PD-L1 negative, they can still benefit from anti-PD-1 alone. We know that from the trials. But because they may get added benefit from adding Ipi, if I think I can get away with it, I'll add Ipi to that individual.
I was just flashing a work with your colleague Dan Petrylak in GU, and you know, I was thinking about the strategy some of the people do there where they'll start LHR guidance, see how people do, and then add in whatever, chemo or hormones. What about that strategy in your 70-year-old, starting with PD-1 alone and then adding Ipi if the patient doesn't respond?
So I always leave that option open. If I start with anti-PD-1 alone and they don't respond, I'll then go and give them the combination if I think they can tolerate it. But I don't do that in every patient because I'm always concerned that things have changed when you've had some progression. And even though you might salvage some of those patients with a combination at that point, the tumor has grown, the tumor is bigger. Who knows how you've modified the immune microenvironment by giving anti-PD-1 alone. And so I'm not a fan of that approach in patients in whom I think I should give the combination to up front.
So what happened when you started the Ipi-Nivo?
So he tolerated relatively well. He had a rash at the beginning after cycle 3. He had a little bit of diarrhea, but I didn't need to give him steroids. It resolved on its own. He came in after that third cycle, and he was complaining of myalgias, fatigue, had weight loss. His free T4 was elevated, so as commonly in these patients, you see a thyroiditis. You don't really need to do very much about it. We went ahead and gave him the fourth cycle. And then a few days after giving him the fourth cycle, he called with blurry vision. He said it was intermittently severe. He couldn't read very well. He had more nausea, early satiety. He actually didn't feel very well. He also was a little bit orthostatic. So we brought him in. We had ophthalmology see him, and they confirmed that he had bilateral anterior uveitis. But anterior uveitis doesn't make me as nervous as posterior uveitis. He also had posterior uveitis. So we immediately brought him into the hospital, gave him solumedrol, a gram a day for 3 days, and then went down to prednisone 100 milligrams daily with a very slow taper, and obviously the ophthalmologist gave him steroid eye drops. He didn't really call us. In fact, he missed one of his subsequent appointments, but eventually came back in. We did an MRI of the brain and of the orbits. It looks like things were getting better. We continued the steroid taper, and then on September the 18th, which was about 3 months after we had started the Ipi-Nivo, we did the scans. And he had amazing resolution of disease. All of these masses, the subcutaneous masses, were gone. I couldn't find them on exam anymore. It was an amazing response. So we've continued the prednisone eye drops. We've tapered the steroids. He still has some visual. He's 80% back, 90% back, not 100% back. We're not going to give him nivolumab maintenance because he had such a wonderful response, and we're just going to scan him about every 3 months in the clinic. He's also, by the way, developed amazing vitiligo. I mean,
really?
Which we see, yeah. It's not uncommon.
Is that associated with benefit?
I don't know if it's associated with benefit, but you see it in a lot of people who develop these great responses.
Huh. He's Caucasian?
Yes.
He just lost pigment everywhere.
Yeah, and that's not uncommon in our patients with melanoma. We don't see it in kidney cancer very often. In fact, almost never. But in melanoma, we see development of vitiligo quite often.
Why do you think that is?
Well, what's probably happening is that there's epitope spreading. So when you attack the melanoma cells, the T cells that are really important are the ones that are attacking the neoantigens. But at the same time, when you're releasing all these antigens, you're probably developing an immune response against normal melanocyte antigens.
Wow.
And then those go on and attack your normal melanocytes and cause vitiligo.
Do you see anything in the mucosa or the eyes?
Well, this is an example of the uveitis is probably an on-target effect, right? It's probably the same immune response that was causing the vitiligo is probably causing the uveitis.
Interesting.
So we see this quite commonly, and my favorite story is of our first patient who developed uveitis. She developed after the first dose. She had a mucosal melanoma that had spread to multiple sites. Within a couple of weeks of the first dose, she developed terrible uveitis. We put her on high-dose steroids. When she came back, she had an amazing response. And then the drug monitor, this was on a trial, had asked me, he said, this is a toxicity. And I said, it's not a toxicity, it's an on-target effect. And he asked me why I thought that. I said, well, because you're attacking melanocytes in the eye, so this must be an immune response that's attacking the melanoma and it's cross-reacting with normal melanocytes. But at the time, when I saw the patient in the clinic, she came back in and I hadn't undressed her yet, and she still had black hair and black eyebrows. And I said to her, you know, I'm wondering whether you've noticed any patches of whitening of your skin or lightening of the skin. And she goes, well, actually, a couple of weeks ago, all my hair turned white, but I dyed it.
Wow.
So she actually had a non-target effect, very similar to this patient.
Wow. Well, anyhow, it sounds like even though it was pretty scary, but great outcome.
It's a great outcome. And we've had other people with visual problems. They've recovered their vision. And I think he'll go on with a very long, durable CR. We don't know yet, of course, because it's only been a few months. But I think he'll do very well.
You had some patients with toxicity that I thought we could just maybe, rather than go through the whole case, really just focus more on the toxicity, beginning with the 47-year-old patient with the dermatologic toxicity.
So this is a gentleman who had a primary ocular melanoma to liver and bone. As you know, we don't have a lot to treat these patients with. We have a rare patient who has benefit from ipilimumab nivolumab with an ocular metastatic melanoma. We've had several over the course of the years. We went ahead and treated him with ipilimumab nivolumab. He developed a rash initially, was treated normally. We didn't do anything about it because it looked like a routine rash. He then went on and developed colitis, which we treated with steroids, our standard high-dose steroid regimen. But while he was on steroids, he called and reported bleeding from hemorrhoids. He wasn't eating very well. He was orthostatic. And then he said at about the same time, again, he was on steroids at the time, that he had developed this new rash on the back of the legs that was spreading very rapidly. He was on Bactrim at the time because we had put him on Bactrim as prophylaxis for the prolonged steroids that he had been on. He came into the ER, was seen by a dermatology resident in the ER, and the dermatology resident immediately said, this is Stevens-Johnson syndrome. So he was admitted to the hospital, was put on very high-dose steroids.
Could you describe kind of his physical exam at that point?
The dermatologist described it as hundreds of red, dusky, irregularly shaped macules and thin papules coalescing into large patches and thin plaques on the trunk. And at that time, there were some erosions on the skin, but no mucosal involvement.
Did they biopsy the skin?
They did. It showed epidermal necrosis and lymphoplasmacytic infiltrate, consistent with essentially Stevens-Johnson syndrome. So he was stable for a couple of days, but you could see the rash spreading into his palms and his soles with a lot more blisters and erosions. Eventually, just sheets of skin started coming off. Still had diarrhea. He went to the ICU. We tried to give him infliximab. I think the management of Stevens-Johnson syndrome is a little bit controversial. When I spoke with the dermatologist, they weren't all that interested in giving him steroids or the infliximab, as I recall. But we did. His continued to get worse. He was transferred to a burn unit for management and died while he was in the burn unit.
Wow, that's terrible.
It's a terrible story.
Can you talk a little bit about the spectrum of dermatologic problems? I know that low-grade problems are pretty common. What kinds of low-grade problems do you see, and what are some of the severe problems?
The low-grade problems really are things that we mostly ignore. It's pruritus and then patches of erythema, sometimes punctate lesions. Not anything that we pay much attention to, and people tolerate it very well. We give them triamcinolone cream or whatever it is that they want to use, more than just the hydrocortisone creams that you can get over the counter to treat the rash. They do very well. We often have them seen by the dermatologist, but it's not necessary because they do okay. there's a group of patients that can develop very severe rashes. I'm not a dermatologist, but we've seen bullous pemphigoid, and we've had to stop treatment because of the bullous pemphigoid, so they develop blistering lesions on their skin. So far, nothing life-threatening. The most severe skin reactions, there are patients who come in with really grade 4 rashes. It's not Stevens-Johnson syndrome. It's not bullous pemphigoid, but they're covered head to toe in what, it's an erythema, but it's almost an indurated erythema. You can almost feel it. It looks very scary. But again, you can treat them with oral steroids and topical steroids, and they tend to do quite well. And then the one Stevens-Johnson syndrome that I discussed a few minutes ago.
Why don't we finish out with the last patient, your 31-year-old man with the mucosal melanoma.
So this is a gentleman, he's black, and he presented to an urgent care clinic with 2 weeks of constipation. He said he felt something pop while he was having a bowel movement, and he felt a soft mass in his rectum. And of course, when most of these people go to the doctor, it's diagnosed initially as hemorrhoids, but eventually he was seen by a surgeon, they did a biopsy, and it turned out to be a rectal melanoma, mucosal melanoma. They did an excisional biopsy, but they also scanned him at the time, and it turned out that he had not only multiple subcentimeter pulmonary nodules, not skin lesions, he also had lymphadenopathy, and he had a liver lesion that was clearly suspicious for metastatic disease. He also had retroperitoneal implants, so he had a fairly disseminated disease. We sent an Oncomine panel because about 10 to 15% of these people will have c-KIT mutations. And although we wouldn't treat them with c-KIT inhibitors first, if they don't respond to the immune therapy, it gives us a second line of treatment.
As long as you brought that up, what is your second line? What would you do?
If he had a c-KIT mutation, believe it or not, we start most people on sorafenib.
That's interesting. What do we know about the response in that situation?
We don't have any organized data. A lot of people use imatinib and dasatinib. I use sorafenib because some of the KIT mutations that we see are only sensitive to sorafenib, or are mostly sensitive to sorafenib, not as sensitive to imatinib and dasatinib. The other thing I like about sorafenib is that it's a VEGF receptor inhibitor. And I've treated patients who have been on imatinib, dasatinib. They've progressed on that and then put them on sorafenib and seen wonderful responses to second-line treatment with sorafenib. So we started doing this many, many years ago, and sorafenib has just been our go-to drug for patients who we treat with c-KIT inhibitors.
So what happened with this patient?
I did the PD-L1 staining, and as we would expect with a mucosal melanoma, he had no staining, less than 1% of tumor cells, zero immune cell staining. That's true for the majority of patients with mucosal melanomas. If they are PD-L1 positive, by the way, the data would suggest that they can respond to single-agent anti-PD-1 fairly well as a cutaneous melanoma. But most of them don't have PD-L1 staining. They don't respond to anti-PD-1, so we gave him ipi-nivo. He tolerated the therapy really well. Very soon after we started treating him, we noticed vitiligo. And in a black male, it's very striking. I mean, really striking.
Complete vitiligo?
No.
A patchy?
Very patchy, but there are areas that were complete vitiligo. But overall, if you look across all his skin surface, it was patchy. He did very well. He developed a little bit of arthralgias, but tolerated the treatment very well. And when we did his first CAT scan, everything was better. He had a great response. About a third of patients who have metastatic mucosal melanomas will have great responses to ipi-nivo. We had to hold his treatment once, gave him a short course of steroids for the arthralgias. He came off, then we put him on nivolumab maintenance again, and we've been scanning him ever since. He's a near CR. He's had no progression now for months. I actually have a PET scheduled for him this coming month, and if his PET is negative, I'm going to stop his treatment.
How many cases like this do you see every year?
I'd say we see somewhere between 5 to 10 mucosal melanomas, metastatic mucosal melanomas per year. More like 5, I guess.
Where's the primary usually?
Well, we see them sinonasal primaries, vaginal primaries, and rectal primaries primarily. We see them across all sides. So the vaginal primaries obviously come to us from the gyn oncologist. The rectal primaries, like him, came from a surgeon. But we also get a number of these from our head and neck surgeons.
Do these patients usually present with metastatic disease, or do you see some that are localized, surgically cured?
We see some that are localized, and some of them are cured. But our impression is that these patients have, for the same depth and stage, if you use the standard staging for cutaneous melanoma, that they have a higher risk for recurrence.
And do you see BRAF positivity with mucosal melanoma?
The answer is Yes, but much, much lower frequency. And I'm trying to remember whether I've ever actually seen one, and I can't remember whether I've actually seen one that's BRAF mutant. Conjunctival melanomas can be BRAF mutant positive. I can't remember seeing a rectal, a vaginal, or a sinonasal one that's, but I think they're reported in the literature.
Do you ever see cases where you consult about adjuvant therapy with mucosal melanoma?
So, yes. And it is a problem because not enough of these patients have gone on to the randomized trials to know whether Nivo would work. My own suspicion is that nivolumab as a single agent in these patients would not work well because it doesn't work very well in the metastatic disease setting. So I have tried to get ipilimumab nivolumab for a couple of patients who I wanted to treat in the adjuvant setting because I thought they were very high risk, but it's actually not approved by insurance companies. There is a trial ongoing, I think, at the Mayo Clinic, a single-arm study. In fact, I just saw a patient within the last 2 weeks that had a vulvar melanoma that was very deep, 8 millimeters deep, was ulcerated. She had bilateral sentinel nodes. The sentinel nodes were negative, but I think she's at very high risk. She had perineural invasion. She had many, so 17 mitoses per millimeter squared. I realize those are not used in the staging system, but when you look overall at this lesion, you just get a sense that she's at very high risk for recurrence. So I wanted to offer her ipi-nivo, and at this point, I haven't yet been able to get the insurance companies to approve it.